Good morning, everyone. It's time to bring you reports from our staff observers in England, Germany, and Washington. We start our roundup on this 592nd day of war with a report from the Island Fortress. Will you go ahead, London?
This is John McVane in London. Smoke from the smoldering ashes of many fires today spread an eddying gray pall over London. Firemen with faces streaked with grime and sweat are still working, as they worked last night under a hail of bombs, to damp out the embers of fires that scarred this city as it has never been scarred before in any one night. London has taken a lot. It will take much more. But last night was the raid that, for sheer concentrated savagery, will long be remembered by those who saw it and can tell about it today. Five of the raiders were shot down. The Luftwaffe poured everything it had on London. They killed many people. They wounded many others. They destroyed homes and offices and stores with high explosives and firebombs. You've probably heard and seen much about the raid, so perhaps the best way to tell you about it will be from the personal point of view of NBC's London staff. It was soon after dark that we heard the first raiders. I was in an apartment house three streets from the NBC office. From the first, it seemed the raid was going to be a heavy one. The drone of heavy and light bombers never stopped, except for, I think, between 20 and 30 seconds, three or four times during the night. Dinner had been late. Just before we were ready for coffee, we heard a big one coming. It came with a roaring, tearing noise that never seemed to stop, and we went down on our faces in the living room. You don't feel frightened at a time like that. You were too busy waiting for the explosion. The shock of the explosion jiggled the heavy concrete building like a birch tree in the wind. We thought the building had been hit, but as soon as we picked ourselves up, we knew it had been a miss. Someone guessed it had landed in a nearby park, and we had a cup of coffee to brace ourselves. We had just finished the coffee when the apartment doorbell rang. At first, I didn't recognize the callers. They were NBC's two girl secretaries and another girl friend. Their faces were streaked with dirt, and dust had been driven through their clothing and the pores of their skin. They'd been sitting in the NBC office when the big bomb landed. It had leveled half a dozen nearby houses, literally to the ground. I mean, it turned them into heaps of broken wood and rubble. There were no houses or anything that looked like houses left. The blast had blown in the windows and window frames of the NBC office. Smashed partitions and walls, wrecked furniture, and torn doors from the hinges. One wall fell on one of the girls, but she managed to get out without a scratch. Just before the bomb came, one girl had brought in her jewel case from another room. The other had put on a favorite bracelet. They said they somehow felt that something might happen, and they wanted their most precious possessions nearby. In the eerie light of burning buildings next door, they picked their way out of the shattered offices to reach my apartment. Most of their clothing had been destroyed. We gave the girl stimulants and sat around together. After a while, we got tired of sprawling onto the floor from the couch and chairs every time a bomb came close. So after a while, we just sat around on the floor. Every once in a while, you would hear the scream of a dive bomber shooting down through the barrage to let a bomb go from a low level. It was something new, because always before, the raiders have stayed very high. It began to get later and later, and the raid didn't let up for a minute, so I began to get to work, finding out details of the attack. We learned they were heavy everywhere over the London area. After a while, I went to the studio. On the way, you could see the sky lit in every direction by the great tongues of flame. Firemen and rescue workers were working on some ruins nearby. It seems trite to say that they are brave men and women. They are so brave that anything you can say about them falls short of the truth. Down another street, a gas main had been hit, and fire was springing up on both sides of the street and in the center as well. From a high building, you could see other fires. Great cauldrons of leaping flame and rolling smoke columns made a sight you could never forget, even when you've seen every other big raid on London. I made a broadcast from an underground studio and then went home. We were all sitting in the apartment when we heard some bombs come down without exploding. Then came that ominous crackle that meant firebombs. Some of us went out in the yard. A dozen men and women were working on a firebomb. We got it out, then saw another sparkling on the roof. Nine floors up, we got after that one. I was pumping a stirrup pump when a man came by with a sandbag and dumped it on the bomb. He was talking an accent that I knew. He came from Brooklyn. On our way down, we met other people coming up with water and sand. Women in light negligees were lugging dirty bags of sand and smiling while they did it. The American from Brooklyn joined us, and we sat around drinking his American coffee. Some buildings nearby hadn't been so lucky in getting out their incendiaries, and they were all afire. Once in a while, we went to the roof to see how things were going. Ours is a residential district. Once I counted 17 fires. I had been told many more were going in practically in other parts of the London area. A little before dawn, the raid suddenly stopped. The only sound you could hear was the pumping of the fire engines and the distant crackling of the fires. Suddenly, one of the secretaries said, "Listen." We listened and heard a strange sound. It was birds chirruping. We lifted the blackout curtains and saw that the dawn had come. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
This is New York. Now from the Associated Press, Rome. An Italian army driving up the Yugoslav coast from Albania has occupied Cetinje, Yugoslavia, a scant 10 miles from Kotor, and is pushing northward to meet another fascist motorized column moving southward on Dubrovnik. We're ready now for our reporter in the Reich. Will you go ahead, Berlin?
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. Early this morning and last night, the Germans made a heavy reprisal attack on London for the bombing of Berlin a week ago by the Royal Air Force. A special high command communique just released says that the German Air Force bombarded the British capital for 10 solid hours. It declares that the attack was carried out in revenge for the destruction of private and cultural centers in Berlin and Potsdam during the night of April 9th to 10th. Large formations of bombers attacked London in waves, and it's said that the ports and industrial sections were heavily hit. Weather conditions and visibility are said to have been excellent throughout the night, and a large number of fires were started on both banks of the Thames. While the bombardment of London was going on, the RAF was over northern Germany in the coastal regions. The Germans say that only a few British planes succeeded in reaching their objectives, and that the damage caused was insignificant. The rest of the British pilots are said to have jettisoned their bombs without attempting to hit objectives of any kind. The Germans say that one of their night fighters shot down a British plane. How the map of Europe will look when the war in the Southeast is finished is what every political observer here would like to know. Today, this question was raised on the Wilhelmstrasse. An official said that political questions can't be decided until the fighting is over. But that time is not far away. Then he said everything will be dealt with in its proper order. He added that the Serbs had been asked to cooperate with the new order in Europe once, but they had turned down the offer. This time, he said, the Germans will do the job alone, without the Serbs. The German attitude, he declared, is that one doesn't let a cuckoo lay an egg in one's nest twice. When asked if the new order in the Southeast would be formed within the framework of the three-power pact, he retorted that Japan wasn't the neighbor of Yugoslavia. Nothing is known about a reported movement of Romanian troops into that part of Yugoslavia where there is said to be a Romanian minority. A Wilhelmstrasse official simply remarked that in any case, the Germans are there already. Referring to documents found in a wrecked plane said to have been carrying Yugoslavian officials, he said that he hoped the incriminating documents would furnish the basis of a new German white book. The question of Germany's position in regard to Egypt was touched on. Germany, it was declared, has no claim against Egypt. But it's the German policy to strike at the British wherever they are. So, if they are in Egypt, Germany will hit them there. The same official said he couldn't say whether or not Russia would join the three-power pact. What's left of the disorganized Yugoslavian forces is said to be crumbling rapidly before the fast advance of the German armies. Following the capitulation of the 2nd Yugoslavian Army at Sarajevo, hourly reports arriving in Berlin tell of other units surrendering to the Germans. From here, it appears that the remnants of the Yugoslav armies are scattered. Units are cut off from the main body of troops and, in some cases, large concentrations completely isolated. Apparently, one of the difficulties the advancing Germans have to contend with is a guerrilla resistance being put up by some of these isolated groups in the mountains and badlands. In Greece, the British, instead of re-embarking, are said to be fighting the Germans on a front extending from Mount Olympus to the hills to the west, before the plain of Larissa. The Germans claim that their speed troops were so fast that they have forced the British to fight. So, according to German papers this morning, it's a case of having to fight whether the British like it or not. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
This is New York. That's the latest in England and Germany. Next, Earl Godwin gives his regular morning report from our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Those two broadcasts in Berlin and London, particularly London, make the comment of William S. Knudsen, director of the Office of Production Management, newsy this morning. Of course, we know Knudsen is in favor of continuing labor policies, but he's against what he calls unnecessary strikes. And he says, when I think of the people abroad hoping for help from the United States to save a piece of the roof over their heads, it makes me blush to think that we over here bicker about silly, small differences which seldom, even after they're settled, mean any gain to anybody. That was Bill Knudsen speaking in New York, but what he says in New York is going to be Washington news today, because he is the production man on defense, and he said that strikes called simply to take advantage of the defense program are nothing short of criminal. There's going to be plenty popping in this town today, too, when the opposition begins to work on the new order, freezing steel prices just where they were in the first quarter of this year. This order is the first major defense move of Leon Henderson, who really wanted to be a member of the group of which Knudsen and Hillman are tops, but who was saved by the president for this price-fixing committee. Henderson was Harry Hopkins' economist in the days when relief was a major activity in Washington, remember? Well, the president has promised the nation that there will be no sky rides for commodity prices. Costs of living will be held down as far as possible. Remember, really, that was one of the very first things the president said when he appointed and explained this defense committee and defense council, which now has charge of this tremendous buying and manufacturing program. There's no direct law on this price-fixing subject as I see it. If there is any law at all, it will be found in bits and pieces of laws and statutes here and there, as if someone went up into the attic and dragged out the old trunks and searched them here and there for bits of to make a new, now don't find fault with me when I say this, a new crazy quilt. Because that's just the way it looks to some of these boys, like Senator Taft, who is firmly of the opinion that the president just does not have authority for arbitrary price fixing. We can look to Taft to start an assault on this steel price fixing. However, I'll say this much for Henderson. He left the door wide open for an argument from the steel business. And there's no doubt they will argue in vast numbers. They have no stomach for swallowing $90 million a year in wage increases and no chance to pass the buck to the general public and the taxpayers. Incidentally, American business evidently wants to help and help in a big way in this defense program, wants to make the defense program a huge success. Washington officials of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States say that businessmen are working out a program to help speed defense program. And speed is essential, and as John Biggers said the day before yesterday, there is absolutely no substitute for time. Hundreds and hundreds of suggestions along this line of speeding up defense and the manufacture of defense have reached the Chamber of Commerce, and I think they will probably form the basis for a defense platform which will be adopted at the Chamber of Commerce annual meeting later this month. And of course, you know, that's American big business gathering here. Strike news still gives Washington a dull headache. The Army now complains that the soft coal strike has closed down enough steel furnaces to make a noticeable lag in the steel production which the Army needs so badly. Northern mines cannot open until southern mine owners agree on the same northern terms. And there's a deadlock there between mine owners, mind you. The southern mine owners say that the schedule of wages and hours for the northern mines cannot be made operative in the south without breaking the mines. 20 congressmen from southern states have signed up to ask the president of the United States to put this soft coal trouble up to the mediation board. But the head of the workers, John Lewis, head of the United Mine Workers, said, busting agency, and I think there's going to be trouble there. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news at this time from Washington.
During the past quarter hour, you've heard our regular week morning roundup of reports from our observers in England, Germany, and Washington. Throughout the day, this station brings you many other such regularly scheduled newscasts. Our complete schedule is in your newspaper. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Replacing the announced program, NBC brings you a special report from overseas. During last night's fierce air raid on London, the NBC offices in the British capital were wrecked by a bomb. For a first-hand account of what happened, we take you now to London.
This is John McVane in London. London today is taking stock of the injuries inflicted on it by last night's big air raid, the biggest in the British capital's 7 months of bomb experience. The raid took a heavy toll of life, but so far no final count has been made, and rescue squads are still digging in ruins, hoping against hope that some people may still be alive. The German bombs raked practically every part of the London area. You find plenty of streets blocked off because of debris or unexploded bombs. I went around part of the center of London today on taxi and on foot. Hose lines still snake through some streets as firemen wet down the embers. Some of the debris will take a long time before it can be cleared up. This morning, many workers hitchhiked to work and arrived hours late. Sometimes when they got there, they found their offices had been blasted into heaps of brick and plaster by direct hits, or that near misses had wrecked the interior so badly as to make the shops and offices useless. Deep in everyone in London today, there is no despair, but there is the growing conviction that the nation that inflicted this thing on the people of London should be paid back, and paid back in the same coin. Official air circles aren't saying anything, but you can be very sure that the first night when the weather is right, British bombers will be laying Britain's newest and most destructive bombs on Germany. I found some grim amusement in London at the German communique's statement that the raid was a reprisal for the British raid on what the communique calls the residential quarters and cultural institutions of the German capital. Londoners are wondering what the heavy raids on London last fall were reprisals for. Some informed circles here note that the British raid on Berlin has provoked what they call an almost hysterical response. If last night's raid is an indication that the British bombing of Berlin has touched German morale to the quick, you can be sure that the Nazis will be touched again and again on the same soft spot. As for the morale of the Londoners, it would take a lot more than last night's raids to have any appreciable effect on it. The raids were bad. Many people lost their homes and many lost friends and relatives. Nobody liked it, and nobody hopes to see another one. But whether they come again tonight and tomorrow night and next month or next year, they can't hammer fear or the thought of defeat into these people of London. At least that's how it seems to most American observers here. The raids began soon after dark. Judging the number of bombers used in the raids is pretty much guesswork. Maybe the raiders come over London once, and maybe they come over two or three times from the nearby French aerodromes across the Channel. If you figure that around 400 to 600 bombers spent the night dumping firebombs and high explosives and everything that German bombers carry onto London, you'll get some general idea of how it was. They came high, and some of them came fairly low, although it isn't thought that any dive bomb down into the balloon barrage that lifts its steel tentacles to guard the city against low-level precision bombing. To those of us who are in the center of the city, the bombs seem to keep showering down like rain that would never stop. Some of the raiders drop their bombs one by one, and others let them go in sticks of two or three or more. The incendiaries, many of them from Molotov cocktails that explode in air and shower out the bombs in a cluster, started blazes that lit the sky. From rooftops, some of the fires looked like volcanoes, bubbling jets of flame in the air. Weaving columns of smoke rose into the sky and knit with smoke from other blazes in the same area. As you walked down some streets, you had to pick your way over the hoses. The throbbing of the fire engine pumps cut out any chance of hearing a bomb come down, and you began to wonder whether you'd hear a bomb in time to throw yourself on the sidewalk or the roadway. The German raiders got 8 London hospitals. Churches, movie theaters, and other buildings were hit or damaged. Today, many well-known streets have gaping craters. Sometimes you come across a line of houses with holes knocked in them by light bombs. Again, you can see perhaps half a dozen houses leveled down to the ground by a huge explosion. The chief office of a building society caught a shower of firebombs. A large bomb fell in a restaurant, and some of the staff were casualties, but there were no diners there at the time. Another bomb wrecked a theater, and the doorman is missing. A store in the West End, which was badly damaged by fire, had a note on the door stating, "Store temporarily closed." It was feared today that many people were killed when a high-explosive bomb fell in the courtyard of a working-class block of flats in one London district. A surface shelter in the courtyard was wrecked. Rescue workers worked in the darkness to locate the people. Ambulances stood by waiting to rush the victims to the hospital. Policemen from a neighboring police station, which itself was damaged, rescued people from their bombed homes. Five prayer watchers were killed in a southwest London church when the building received a direct hit. They were standing outside when they heard the whistle of the bomb and ran inside for shelter. A warden was killed and four others were missing after a heavy bomb demolished a row of houses and several shops in East London. The houses collapsed in the basement shelter, burying more than 50 people, but most were extricated today. Members of a rescue squad were killed when a bomb fell immediately in front of their van in which they were speeding to a bombing incident. In a church, a priest and several nuns risked their lives to save church vessels. Rescue workers dug through wreckage for people who had been underneath in a church shelter. Emergency dressing stations were set up to look after the wounded. One of these treated 300 cases, and many of the doctors hastily mobilized from the neighborhood worked in pajamas. Londoners are reading this sort of thing in their paper today. To sum up, the Luftwaffe had good weather last night. The moon rose late, and it wasn't full enough for the night fighters to work under their best conditions. Six raiders were shot down. Most Londoners hope the raiders won't get off so easily the next time. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
You've just heard a special report from London concerning last night's intensive air raid on the British capital, in which the NBC offices there were wrecked by a bomb. This is the National Broadcasting Company.